In a few minutes, South Texas author Noe Torres speaks about his latest book, Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. An Edinburgh native, Noe has written 8 books about historic UFO cases, and his work has been featured on numerous radio and TV shows, including the History Channel. Let's welcome Mr. Noe Torres.
Okay, thank you all for coming today. We're trying to make events like this
Headline edition, July
something that's... let me hold on a second here on this. I forgot I had that audio triggering. Sorry about that. We're trying to make events like this more common here in the Valley. This is the first major UFO conference that we've had. And it all started because, you know, we saw how, for example, Roswell, New Mexico makes such a big festival every year in the summer, and it's such a wonderful event, family friendly, and people come from all over the world. So we wanted to have a little bit of that Roswell experience here in South Texas, and that was our thinking when I proposed it to the city of Edinburgh and the public library in Edinburgh. So we're very thankful and gratified for you all's support today. Okay, I'm going to be speaking today about my latest book, which is called Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. And it is one of the most interesting UFO stories that I personally have ever run across. And it was investigated by some of the real heavyweights in the field at that time, including J. Allen Hynek, whom those of you who are here for Stanton Friedman's morning presentation, he mentioned Dr. Hynek as being one of the most legitimate of the scientists who were investigating UFOs in the 1960s, 70s, and so forth. So J. Allen Hynek considered this to be one of the strongest points of evidence to support the theory that some UFOs are extraterrestrial craft. And this story is very intriguing. It has firsthand eyewitness testimony from two of the individuals involved. It has the sighting of two different kind of craft and two different kinds of beings, as you're about to find out as the story unfolds. Okay, let's see if we can advance the next slide here. I'm going to set the stage for you. This is not a Texas story. This happened in California. My co-author, with whom I wrote the book Mexico's Roswell and also The Other Roswell, is Ruben Uriarte, and he lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he and I have worked together on many UFO projects and also have spoken at a number of events throughout the country. We also have spoken at the annual Roswell UFO Festival. So as you can see on this map, here is the area where Ruben lives. And then just north of there is Sacramento, where part of the story I'm going to tell you today took place. And then over here, heading up toward Reno, right in here where you see this green shaded area, that is the area where this incident happened. It's a very rugged wilderness, forested area. It actually, the place where it happened and some of the events that took place resemble in a lot of ways the Travis Walton story, which you're going to hear later this afternoon and evening. Which is one of the most remarkable UFO stories that I, you know, had ever heard prior to this one as well, both being extremely interesting. So so we're talking about near Sacramento, and then in this area right here between Sacramento and Reno. And sometimes I do this presentation at conferences and events, and somebody in the audience will raise their hand and say, "Hey, I know that place. I've been hiking out there." So, in fact, my good friend Stephen Androsko, who gave the presentation this morning on South Texas X-Files, has actually been there himself. My co-author Ruben has been, but I haven't personally gone so yet. Okay, so basically the story is these three guys who worked in Sacramento at a big government contracting firm called Aerojet Corporation. Now, those of you who listened to Stanton Friedman this morning, you heard him mention Aerojet as being one of the companies that he worked for when he was employed in doing government defense contracting work on nuclear-powered rocket engines and also nuclear shielding. So Aerojet was one of the companies that Stanton Friedman consulted for as a nuclear physicist. And back in the 1960s, 1964, when this happened, Aerojet's big plant, where they conducted a lot of their rocket and missile building activities, was in Sacramento, California. And the three gentlemen who took part in this story were all three employed by the Aerojet Corporation. Our principal eyewitness with whom we wrote the book, whose story we tell in the book, was a gentleman named Donald Shrum. And he was 28 years old at the time this happened. He still lives today. He's in his late 70s. And he gave us permission to disclose his story for the first time in complete detail, naming all of the names and telling all of the information for the first time ever, the only time that his story has ever been officially told with all the information contained. And that was in the book that Ruben Uriarte and I co-wrote called Aliens in the Forest. Donald Shrum is the principal eyewitness. And also on that hunting trip that weekend was a gentleman named Vincent Alvarez. Mr. Alvarez gave sworn eyewitness written testimony that he saw the initial entry into the area of the large mothership, which Mr. Shrum testified to. A large disc-shaped object, 150 feet in diameter, that moved extremely fast. At one point, it was hovering just a few hundred feet from Mr. Shrum's position, and a second later, it looked like a star up in the sky. That's how fast it moved. And the third member of the hunting expedition that day was a gentleman named Tim Trueblood. Mr. Trueblood has never given a comprehensive statement of what his feelings were about what happened. He did state that he could tell that Mr. Shrum had been through a very traumatic experience. In fact, he suffered the symptoms of someone who has post-traumatic stress syndrome, Mr. Shrum did, following his ordeal, which lasted 12 hours, by the way. So Mr. Trueblood has never given a formal statement. He developed psychological problems afterward. He had great fears, as all three men actually did. Mr. Shrum experienced terrible nightmares. He would wake up at night shaking in cold sweat, re-visualizing in his mind the experience that he went through and the strange beings that attempted to abduct him that night. This was investigated, as I mentioned, by many, many famous UFO investigators of the 1960s, including J. Allen Hynek, and also James Harding, and a number of other people of very high credential, all of whom felt that the story in high esteem and felt it was very likely completely true as Mr. Shrum told it. I've spent a lot of time talking to the witness, and he's a down-to-earth, credible person, just an everyday normal person, and he doesn't espouse any strange philosophical views about his experience. He simply tells what he underwent, what he experienced, what his feelings were, what he observed the strange creatures doing around him. He just tells it the way it happens and leaves all the speculating and conjecture and philosophizing to other people. He's just a very simple, nuts and bolts kind of guy. So in partnering with my friend Ruben Uriarte from California on writing of this book, the way this happened was when the story first happened in September 1964, Mr. Strum was employed by United States primary missile and rocket defense contractor, Aerojet. And because he was under U.S. government contract, you know, he was under oath of secrecy, and security was very tight at the plant, and they were always warning employees really to not call attention to themselves in their private lives because of the secret nature of the work that they were doing. So Mr. Shrum did not feel comfortable after he experienced the story, these events, coming out and holding a press conference and saying, hey, this is what happened. So he never told his story in a formal sense to the general public. He told it to a few UFO investigators with the contingency that they wouldn't use his name. So that's the background, basically. And once again, the date is September 4th, 1964. That was a Friday. They had a long weekend, and the three men from Aerojet Corporation went out to the Tahoe National Forest, this highway between Sacramento and Reno. They went off the highway, and they hiked. They left their vehicle parked in a parking area, and then they hiked on down and established a base camp near the Loch Leven Lakes. Okay? And then the three men, during the course of the evening, during the course of the day on Friday, they had Friday off, were planning to be there Friday and Saturday and return home to Sacramento on Sunday. So the three men came down very rugged territory, lots of ravines, lots of pine trees, very difficult to move through. My co-author Ruben Uriarte just recently went down there just a few weeks ago, and he said that it's still as barren and, I mean, as rugged and as difficult to traverse as when this incident happened in 1964. So the three men came on down this way, and they kind of separated. Each one went his or her his own way. As they approached down, this is very rugged wilderness. And then they finally, Mr. Shrum, when he had his encounter with these strange craft and these strange beings, was right in this general area right here. There are no roads to get there. It's just strictly hard hiking and lots of it. Very rugged wilderness area, as I mentioned. This is what Mr. Shrum, who was 26 years old at the time this picture was taken, this is what he looked like. He was employed by Aerojet Corporation, as I've mentioned. And this is a drawing or a sketch that Mr. Shrum did of the area. Remember I mentioned that they set up camp near the Loch Leven Lakes, and then they came down this rugged, rugged area, heavy brush, and then the incident. Interestingly enough, this pine tree that Mr. Shrum put here to represent most of what I'm going to describe in his UFO encounter happened there, right around this pine tree, which actually becomes instrumental to the story. So the men had been hunting. They got separated from each other. They kind of went their own way. To hear Mr. Shrum tell it, there wasn't much to shoot at that evening. Maybe an acre or two, but there wasn't much in the way of game. They were bow and arrow hunting. I don't think I had emphasized that. It wasn't rifle season yet, so the men from time to time would go out bow and arrow hunting. So there wasn't much to shoot at. And they all had an agreement that if they became separated from each other, they couldn't make it back to base camp, they would look for a secure place to rest for the night, maybe in a rocky ledge of boulders, or perhaps, as Mr. Shrum chose to do, up in a tree, because of the frequent bear sightings and an occasional bear attacks that had been reported in this area, as well as other predators. So something very strange happened once Mr. Shrum decided that he had picked a place and he was by this tree. He was going to spend the night there. And then he saw this incredible sight moving toward him. And if you can look at this picture on the right, he caught a glimpse of this bright object kind of in a distance. He was down here, and he was looking up to the north, northeast, and he saw this object kind of meandering across here. And he said, you'll hear in the video clip in a minute, it looked like someone walking up at the top of the ridge carrying a lantern. You know, well, it looked kind of small at that point, but then it made this turn and started coming toward him. Because at first, his impression was that maybe his two hunting companions, after they became separated, had contacted the Forest Service, and they had sent a helicopter after him to find him. So he thought maybe it was a rescue helicopter. And we're going to listen to his description.
And then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of a tree. And I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. And I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks and waved my arms and yelled and screamed and finally that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still. Until it got within, oh, maybe 60 feet or yards. I'm not sure the distance at night. But it just stood, hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. I thought it was something from outer space. But it looked like all I could see is a little, about an 8-inch glow. So I thought it was just a little tiny this, you know, flying saucer. And then I kind of panicked and I threw my bow up in the tree again and hand walked out that limb and got up in the tree. And I had all camouflage clothing on, so I figured, well, they won't see me here, you know. But then this light went a half circle around me over the canyon. Then I could see the shadow of the whole spacecraft. And that was just a light that was on the nose of it.
Okay, the design is very interesting that he describes. And he has sketched this out for us and for other UFO investigators. The object was 150 feet from edge to edge. It was cylindrical shaped, or almost, you could say, pill shaped. And at first, because the hull was generally dark, or very, you know, kind of blended with the night sky, he couldn't tell that there was substance to the hull. I mean, in other words, he couldn't see the solidity of the hull. He was only seeing this light. These three portals or windows did not open until later in the encounter. So at first, if you can imagine, all of this was totally dark and he was seeing only the small light. So at first he thought it was some little small object, you know, flittering around. And, you know, you heard him say, if it was a UFO, it was a real tiny one. But then as it came closer, it came past his position and it kind of hovered over this canyon or ravine just a short distance from where he was. And then he realized he hadn't been seeing the whole extent of the object. It was massive. That's like a 12-story building turned on its side. So now this is very interesting because as you'll hear in a minute, he continued watching this strange object from his position. He was up in the tree, in a pine tree. He had a military-style belt with canteen, so he strapped that to one of the larger branches to secure his position up in the tree. And he continued to watch this incredible object. Here in this, this is a copy of the drawing that Mr. Shrum did, where he describes the object. This was a small light, again, that he initially saw. and then these three panels. And in a while, you're going to listen to him talk about a smaller ship, which he refers to as the scout ship, that came out of one of these three panels, the middle panel, which opened up as he observed the craft. This is an artistic representation of this huge cylindrical object hovering just a short distance at about eye level from Mr. Shrum's position in that tree. And just showing the route again. Now, here is Mr. Shrum's description of how the three panels suddenly glowed into life, opened up, and out of the middle one shot out this smaller object.
And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever. And I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down to in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from.
This object that you first saw that left the center panel, what did it look like, Don?
Well, at that time, all I saw was a flash and saw a dark object go down.
The dark object, what shape was it?
Well, I couldn't really say. It went so fast. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that it, I could see like a half, I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it and looked like the top of a flying saucer. Really? That I'd seen in pictures.
Like a dome? Or
yes. Yeah, like a dome. And then I kept my eyes on that.
Okay, so just to kind of recap what he's talking about, there was this huge craft, 150 feet in diameter, hovering just a short distance from his position, and out of the center panel, right over here, and out of the center panel came this smaller craft, which zoomed across past him and landed at a distance away from him. This was an area of heavy brush between him and where the second object, landed. And then these strange beings came from the direction of the smaller ship. Mr. Shrum heard them kind of crashing through the brush, through the undergrowth, and getting closer to his position. And this is what he has to say.
And I heard some thrashing through the brush, and probably 5-10 minutes, these two humanoids come out of the brush, and they kind of broke some of the brush off and was looking at it. And then they came straight underneath the tree and looked up at me. And I knew right then I was fingered.
They found you.
Yeah, they found me.
Can you describe them for us? That was briefly what they
were. Yeah, they were, looked like 4 or 5 feet. Of course, I'm looking down at them, so they'd be shorter than they probably are. And they had a silvery, like a one-piece suit on, and it seemed like it had the joints, puffy joints, you know, on the shoulders and the elbows and the legs. I didn't see that clear.
The humanoids, were you able to see their faces?
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles. And then the rest of the face was kind of blur. I couldn't see looking down at them.
You're able to see then was it large or small? They're
about 2 inches in diameter. It reminded me just, like I said, like a welding goggles.
Okay. I just want to add that we were very fortunate to have a very talented artist who did the artwork for our book, did the sketches based on Mr. Shrum's testimony. Mr. Neil Reby, who does a lot of illustration work and does graphic novels, and he's a big Godzilla fan, by the way. Anybody here like Godzilla? Okay, a few do. That kind of dates us, I think. Godzilla isn't as popular anymore. Anyway, Neil Reby did all of the illustrations. If you all would like to pick up a copy of Aliens in the Forest, you'll see his amazing work on the sketches. And all of them, you know, we showed them to Mr. Shrum, the eyewitness, prior to publishing the book, and he was just astonished because this was the closest visual representation of what he went through that he had ever seen any artist put down. So he was amazed. Okay, so then a second type of creature arrived, even more bizarre than the first. Mr. Shrum refers to this second being as a robot. But he emphasized to us when we interviewed him that this doesn't necessarily mean that this second type of being was a robot or a mechanical being, but simply that it looked like one. It was about the same shape, size, and general description as the humanoids, what Mr. Shrum called the humanoids. So it was just one of the humanoids in a different type of bulkier suit. So we don't know for certain if this was a distinctly different type of entity or whether it was simply one of the humanoids in a different type of specially adapted suit. So this is the initial description that Mr. Shrum gave right after his sighting, and then this is an enhancement that was done by NICAP investigator Paul Cerny, who was the original investigator in this case. And this is what Mr. Shrum had to say about this robot.
And then I saw two flashing red-orange light eyes just picking its way down the ridge, just between the rocks and around them and everything, and come down and was on this big boulder, this big flat rock. He kind of looked up at me and he moved his hand through the fire cinders and kind of scattered them.
And the eyes of this other creature, like the robot, what did that look like to you?
It had kind of like fire. It's kind of a orangish, reddish orange, or yellowish orange, and it kind of flickered like fire. And they're about the same diameter as about 2 inches in diameter as the humanoids.
Okay, this interview that you're watching video clips from was conducted by my co-author Ruben Uriarte about 6 or 7 years ago. It was one of the initial interviews with the eyewitness. Unfortunately, in the years since, he has developed Parkinson's disease and now has a lot of difficulty speaking clearly.